Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and I'm here today with Michael Hiltzik, who is a journalist who writes for the Los Angeles Times. He won the 1999 Pulitzer Prize, along with Chuck Phillips, for a series on corruption and bribes in the music industry. And he's the author of several books, including a few histories over the last 15 years or so. They include The Plot Against Social Security, How the Bush Administration is Endangering Our Financial Future, 2005, Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century, from 2010, The New Deal, A Modern History, from 2011, and Big Science, Ernest Lawrence and the Invention that Launched the Military-Industrial Complex, from 2015. And today we're here to talk about his brand new book, Iron Empires, Robber Barons, Railroads, and the Making of Modern America, published earlier this year by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Would you start by talking to our listeners, just kind of give an overview of the book and why you chose to write a book on railroads?
Yeah, good questions, both. The book in general is a chronicle of the Gilded Age, or maybe I should say the first Gilded Age, since we've been living through a second Gilded Age recently. And it covers the last third of the 19th century and the first decade or so of the 20th, and tells the story through the eyes of the tycoons who were the most important figures in this era. And by, as it happens, they were railroad tycoons. Because the railroads were America's first big business and really came into their own in this period. So I got interested in it because after my last project, which was the book that you mentioned about Ernest Lawrence, the inventor of the cyclotron, which was a chronicle of physics in the 30s, 40s, and 50s up through the Manhattan Project, I was looking for something new, and I thought about the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. But when I looked into that and doing my initial feasibility studies, I discovered that this was a story that had really been pretty well masticated. There was one 700 or 800 page book that was really detailed. There was a popular history that competed with it. So there wasn't much more to say. And I started thinking, what if we start telling the story not so that it ends in 1869 with the driving of the Golden Spike, but begins in 1869 with the driving of the Golden Spike and then the development of this incredibly important industry from there on in? And my publisher said, well, sure, but you'll have plenty of characters, but do you have an event or a spine that will help tell the story? And as it happened, by then I had come across this epic takeover battle that pitted E.H. Harriman and J.P. Morgan against one another in 1900 and 1901 to control this industry. It was so ferocious that it ended up crashing the New York Stock Exchange in May of 1901. It was a major crash that really destroyed the fortunes of hundreds of small investors. And that became sort of the climax of the story. And then I took it from there to their settlement, which created the Northern Securities Trust, which was the first trust that the trust buster, Teddy Roosevelt, busted. So that sort of brought the story of the Gilded Age full circle and to an end.
Okay. Thank you. You know, and I guess we talk, and you point out, you know, railroads are America's first big business, and I certainly agree with that. In some ways, I feel like, though, that even though that's something that people know, I don't think they quite understand how critical railroads were. Can you talk a little bit about just how the role that railroads played in America in the late 19th century and kind of their transformational impact?
Sure. I mean, when you think about it, 1869, which was the completion of the first transcontinental railroad, started a process of binding the nation together after the Civil War had really torn it apart. So you had a social influence of the railroads. People were moving they were moving around the country in ways that they never had, or that were so much more difficult before the railroads. I mean, it would take, if you were leaving from the East Coast trying to get to San Francisco, that was a 4-week journey over land, by river and land. If you wanted to go to Seattle, which was beginning its reign as an important northwestern port, it was 6 weeks. The railroads came in, not only the first, but the subsequent transcontinental railroads shortened that trip by weeks and weeks and made it cheaper and more comfortable, at least to the people who lived then. So you had that. The railroads, basically, as they stretched across the country to the west, contributed to the settlement of the Midwest. They had financial incentives to bring settlers into the lands, the territory they were crossing, because they needed produce and manufactured goods to transport to this territory that up until then was basically unpopulated and certainly not marginal in economic terms. So the railroads, before the railroads, American economic growth was organic. A community would grow up, would grow, it would expand, and it would create economic activity that the railroads would then go to serve. After 1869, the process was reversed. The railroads had an impetus to get to the West Coast, but on the way, they created their own form of organic growth. They could turn a little hamlet into a great metropolis simply by running their rails through the area. They could take a little hamlet and leave it as a footnote to history by circumventing it. So they had this great effect. So they had a social effect, they had an economic effect, and then they got so big and it was such a complex industry that they created new forms of corporate management that we still have today. And of course, they created a new standard of labor management relations that was pretty ugly at various points in this period, but certainly was new.
Yeah, and I want to talk about several of those points in some detail. And I guess, you know, one way to get into this perhaps is to ask you to, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, I'm reading your book and you know, and other books on this industry and this time, and you have this sort of creation of modern capitalism, and it's a mess. I mean, it's such a messy story. And, you know, I'm wondering if you can characterize a bit what this system of Gilded Age capitalism the railroads are helping to create looks like, and, you know, some of the problems that develop out of it.
Sure. Well, you have to keep in mind that the railroads were their appetite for capital was voracious. They needed a lot of money. This was a labor and material intensive industry. You couldn't build a railroad without having thousands of workers on site. You couldn't operate it without having thousands of employees to help you build it. And yet the degree to which they developed capitalism, it was a very evolutionary process. And in the first decade or 15 years or so of this process, starting with the creation or the completion of the first intercontinental railroad, and even before that, it was basically a haven for scoundrels and mountebanks and robber barons. This was where the term began. For a lot of these original tycoons, they saw the path to profit more not in building railroads per se, but in trading railroad paper. So there was an intense appetite for railroad paper, especially in Europe. European investors would invest with abandon, and they invested through the House of Morgan and some other investment banks that got their start in this period. but there was really no regulation. There was no oversight. So the piratical instincts of this first generation of tycoons were given free rein. So it was a mess. There was a lot of fraud. There was a lot of over leveraging of railroads. There was a lot of skimming off the top. The Credit Mobilier scandal, in which the builders of the Union Pacific basically siphoned off millions of dollars into their own pockets, and really left the Union Pacific as a crippled enterprise for several decades, was a signal achievement in the history of theft and fraud. So you ended up with a patchwork of railroads, a lot of short and medium lines that would connect with each other, but didn't coordinate with each other. So if you were a passenger taking even a modestly medium length trip, you might find yourself dumped off at the end of one line and then have to wait hours, maybe even days, for the next line to come pick you up. They didn't coordinate schedules. They didn't coordinate construction. So one line would have a different gauge, and that's the distance between the tracks, from another. So you couldn't have a through trip on one rail car or driven by one locomotive. You had to change off equipment. After 10 or 15 or 20 years of this, it became clear that this industry really needed to be rationalized. The term was they needed a Bismarck. Otto Bismarck, around the same time, had consolidated all these little German duchies into the Prussian Empire. And the man who really emerged as the candidate for the railroad Bismarck was Pierpont Morgan. He called the railroad presidents together at his home and said, look, you know, you better get straight with me and with everybody, or you are not going to get any more capital from Europe. They're not going to invest in you. And he started the process of consolidating the industry and creating a community of interest, as he put it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that's always struck me about the earlier period of railroad capitalism, before Morgan really starts to centralize it, is that you know, scoundrel behavior that you described so well. And, you know, and it seems like the nation moves from, you know, relatively, yes, there's capitalism before the Civil War, et cetera, and you have other big businesses rising at the same time, but from a society of smallholders, by and large, to these giant corporations almost overnight. And, you know, in a book that where I think that you really, you know, do a great job of focusing on and sort of explaining the personalities of these figures, you know, I'm wondering if you, after thinking about these people for so long, why do you think that this industry just engendered so much just horrible behavior, you know, theft, fraud, political scandals? What is it about railroads or these people that led to, you know, the most notorious corporate behavior, arguably in the nation's history and certainly in the 19th century?
Well, I think part of it is that there was so much money sloshing around that it was just irresistible. You know, the government subsidized a lot of this construction, certainly subsidized the meeting of the Union Pacific and Central Pacific to create the first transcontinental by offering cash subsidies based on the mileage that they would build, and land subsidies, land grants that the railroads would have to fill if they were going to make a profit. And, you know, when you are selling potential settlers on coming into an unpopulated territory and making their way, you're going to be inclined to overstate the Garden of Eden aspects of it, which they did. Jay Cook, in particular, when he started to build the Northern Pacific, it was known as Jay Cook's Banana Republic, because he was promoting this as just this, you know, just put a stick in the ground and you will have orchards everywhere. So there was a lot of money. There was no regulation to speak of. There was competition. These guys would build railroads that would parallel existing lines just so that they could goad the original owner into buying them out. So you had all of this excess construction. And when you had construction, you had the opportunity for rifling the money off. And that was done. And it really took 20 years or more, even before Morgan, you began to see some understanding by the tycoons that trading paper wasn't going to be enough. They actually needed to build railroads and build them efficiently and effectively, or they weren't going to get any business. And you begin to see that trend really around the 1870s. But then, of course, you had the panic and crash of 1873, which occurred because the railroads were so undercapitalized and overleveraged and just couldn't survive even a modest downturn. Yeah.
And, you know, you alluded to this earlier, but this, you know, the railroads also transformed labor relations in America. And of course, I'm very interested in that. And so I was wondering, you know, what your take is on the labor issues that the railroad industry engenders at this time and the brutality that could at times encapsulate.
Yeah, I think you're right in focusing on that. So the first aspect is you suddenly had a huge labor population. You know, in the 1850s, the biggest American enterprise, and I drew this from Alfred Chandler's work in this sphere. The biggest American enterprise was the Pepperell Mills in Biddeford, Maine, and it had something like at its peak maybe 800 employees. Within a few years, the Pennsylvania Railroad had 50,000 employees. So you can see this is a huge jolt to the labor sector of the American economy. And in the era when the railroads were building ferociously to reach to the West, you had this class of workers who were known as boomers, and they would go to one railroad and they would build out that railroad and start operating it. They were relatively skilled workers. And then when that job was done, they would move on to the next. So there was a huge amount of demand. They were relatively well paid. They thought their jobs were secure. But then when you had an economic downturn, you know, 1873 and again in 1893, the railroad presidents basically had two choices, two paths to survival. They could default on their debt, which they weren't inclined to do because they knew that would destroy their opportunities in the future, or they could liquidate labor. And that's what they chose to do. So you would have these waves of really stringent wage cuts and layoffs. And all of a sudden, the boomers discovered that they weren't indispensable as they thought, after all, and they were prime for organizers. So as you know, as well as anybody, the Knights of Labor, who were formed, I think, in 1869, at the same time as the Golden Spike. This was the first national scale labor organization. It wasn't particularly effective because the organizers of the Knights didn't see their organization as one that was standing in an adversarial relationship with the railroads, their employers. It really came out of the brotherhood theme, you know, where basically you were bringing together these workers and they were going to help out each other to live and survive and to uphold their own welfare. But the Knights were involved in the Great Southwestern Strike. This was 1886. It was a major strike against the Jay Gould railroads. Unfortunately, the leaders of the Knights, particularly Terence Powderly, who was their second president, was really not intellectually or characteristically equipped to deal with Jay Gould. So Gould really took him to the cleaners. Gould misled him and abused him and misused him really just pitilessly. Nevertheless, the Knights had a reputation of being a fairly aggressive labor organization. In 1885, when they staged their first strike, it was surprisingly successful. Their membership got up to 700,000. By 1886, after the second Gould strike, it just diminished incredibly quickly. I think it was probably down to 100,000 within a couple of years. But then the cudgel was taken up by the American Railway Union, which was a much better organized organization. It was led by Eugene B. Debs. It was a railroad union rather than sort of a general union. And it staged and actually got drawn into and then basically ended up leading the Great Pullman Strike of 1894, which was one of the most significant labor actions in American history, as you well know. Pullman Strike started in George Pullman's factory and company town, and he was really one of the most vicious characters in this whole chronicle. And then it threatened to spread to the railroad industry generally until Grover Cleveland sent the troops in. It was the first time that an American president sent troops in over the objection of local officials, including the governor of Illinois, mayor of Chicago. So you do have this evolution. The labor organizations were not all that successful at getting what they wanted. Their goal was an 8-hour day. They got that, though they couldn't make it stick. But it really did become a model for labor organizing in subsequent decades.
Yeah. You know, and I certainly agree with that analysis, especially about Powderly, who was just totally overwhelmed. But it was early in the American labor movement. And, you know, one of the things that always struck me was how unprepared workers were to sort of deal with this new capitalism, how many years it took to actually even understand what it is that they were up against, which maybe has some parallels to today. I don't know. But before we get to talking about today, I do want to explore at least one more question. And I guess I have two parts to this, which is, you know, the centerpiece of your story, again, as you pointed out in the beginning, is the Morgan versus Harriman battle for control of the railroads. And of course, Morgan's well known by the public. Harriman, I think, quite a bit less so. And so maybe you want to talk about that. But, you know, I'm reading your book, and it's not the first time this has struck me, but, you know, the more you get into the way that these railroads are actually operating, the more you begin to think, trust might not be such a bad move here. You know, you almost want to believe in that, you know, eliminating that utterly out of control competition and placing some control over this industry actually seems like a pretty rational move to me, even though they, you know, these monopolies get demonized at the time and for good reason. It becomes pretty easy to convince yourself that it's not such a bad idea.
Yes, in fact, there's a contemporary thread of railroad history that says that the breakup of the Northern Securities Trust, which was basically ordered by the Supreme Court in a ruling that is still taught in law schools today, was probably the wrong thing to do. That it weakened the industry, it recreated an atmosphere of competition that was probably not appropriate for an industry that, when you really break it down, was a natural monopoly. And the model that probably should have been sought, which was a model that really didn't emerge until, I'd say, maybe the late 20s and 30s, is a utilities model. Apportion the market as best you can and then regulate the hell out of it so that you can substitute regulation for market capitalism. We didn't have that. We didn't really get it until it was forced upon us by the decline of the railroads after World War II.
Yeah. So I was unaware of that argument, but I can almost sort of buy it. But would you talk a little bit more about the battle between Morgan and Harriman that so defines your book?
Sure. Well, Morgan, as you said, is pretty well known. He's been, you know, there are many biographies of him and his house. Photographs of him are all over the place. Harriman is much less known, I think, in part because he never really left much of himself. If you want to know about Harriman, you really turn to his associates, who left in many ways very fond recollections of a man who sometimes was vilified by the public, sometimes was treated as a hero. John Muir, for example, left a very sensitive portrait of Harriman. Muir had been invited by Harriman in an 1899 expedition to remote Alaska that Harriman staged as a scientific expedition, and he invited Muir. Muir was a little reluctant to get involved because he didn't trust rich millionaires, but he got to know Harriman during that trip, and his memoir of Harriman after Harriman's death was sort of written with prose from naturalism. You know, he basically describes Harriman as sort of a force of nature. It's a very interesting book. But Harriman, unlike Morgan, was born to the purple. You know, his father had started the House of Morgan. It was understood from the beginning that Pierpont would be the next generation. That they were wealthy. Pierpont was educated in Europe. Harriman was very different. He was the son of an itinerant preacher whose life was a trajectory toward poverty. He left school at the age of 14 to become a pad shover on Wall Street. These were sort of urchins who would go from investment house to investment house with the prices of securities scribbled on their pads and pass them along. But Harriman had this amazing native intelligence and native ambition. He had a preternatural feel for the flows of the securities market and the ambition to make the most of it. By the age of 22, he borrowed the money and bought his own seat on the New York Stock Exchange. And then he got drawn into the railroad business in a couple of ways. One, by a friend and partner named Stuyvesant Fish, whose family was in railroads in New York. And also by his romance with one Mary Averill, who he met when she was visiting relatives in New York City from her upstate New York home. Well, her father in upstate New York had an interest in a railroad. Harriman went up to visit and was asked to sort of take a look at this railroad and see what he could do to fix it. And he did. He turned it into at least profitable enough to be sold. Then Stuyvesant Fish got him involved in the Illinois Central, where Fish was on the board. The two of them really expanded the Illinois Central. And they did it in a way that through Harriman was capital efficient. Somehow, this railroad was able to expand at great expense, but also to have a strong balance sheet. This was something that Harriman was exceptionally good at and was part of his career all the way through to the acquisition of the Union Pacific, then the acquisition of the Southern Pacific, and eventually the fight for the Northern Pacific, which was what brought him into major conflict with Pierpont Morgan. So Harriman, I think the one thing that many people remember or know about Harriman comes from the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. When Butch and Sundance go to rob a Union Pacific train and they're stopped by a Union Pacific clerk who says, "I'm sorry, Mr. E.H. Harriman has entrusted me with this train and I'm not going to let you come in and I'm not going to let you steal the safe," and they blow it up. Then they attack the same train on a return journey, and they find all of a sudden another train shows up, and it's got a mobile posse on it that then chases them across country. And this turns out this was a true story. Harriman did set up this mobile posse. He was sick and tired of Union Pacific trains being robbed. He resolved to stop it. He created this corporate police force, and he stopped robberies on the Union Pacific, to the point that his railroad became known as the safest railroad to travel on or to ship your goods on. So it was a competitive advantage over the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe and the other and the Northern and the Great Northern and the other railroads that were crossing the country at the time. So that, I think, is what, when you talk about E.H. Harriman, people who've seen that movie say, "Oh yeah, gee, that sounds familiar." But other than that, he's not that well known, except for upstate New Yorkers who might live in or around Harriman, New York.
Right, right. So, you know, I mean, like, the story is such a telling story about capitalism and its changes. And I guess as a last question for you before we let you go here, when I'm reading this, I'm also have in the back of my mind contemporary America. And I don't know if that was intentional on your part or not, but the story certainly coalesced to a certain extent. And you already used the term Second Gilded Age, which some of us have used, I've used, some historians are less comfortable with it, but I think it makes a lot of sense. And I'm wondering if you could talk about what when we're reading your book, what is it that we should be thinking about in terms of the present?
Yeah, a couple of things. And in fact, when I was beginning to research the book, I mean, beginning to prepare my proposal, some of these parallels occurred to me really from the start. And one is the evolution of how we think about new technologies and new technologists. And we see a lot of parallels. The railroad tycoons, the evolution was, at first they were seen as heroes. They were the first business leaders in American history to gain social cachet and popular esteem. So they were seen as sort of lions of muscular American capitalism. And then as their railroads became larger and more powerful, more influential, and more controlling over the American economy, you saw a lot of popular skepticism and popular suspicion come in. And I think we've seen that certainly these days with the evolution of how we think about the high-tech tycoons of our age, whether we're talking about Bill Gates or Steve Jobs and Tim Cook or Mark Zuckerberg. In the railroad era, that evolution culminated in hearings before the House of Representatives. These were known as the Peugeot hearings, after Arsène Peugeot, Louisiana congressman who basically launched an investigation of what he called the money trust. And this was basically J.P. Morgan and his compatriots who had just enormous control over the American economy through interlocking directorships, generally on railroads. So Morgan was put in the dock, Harriman was put in the dock, their executives and their partners were all put in the dock, and the extent to which they concentrated control over the American economy was basically put on display. Louis Brandeis, before he became a justice of the Supreme Court, wrote a book really based on those hearings called Other People's Money, in which he really lambasted the concentrated wealth of these tycoons. And I think we see the parallel with the, now we're seeing Zuckerberg and Tim Cook and Jeff Bezos being put on the dock before Congress for very much the same reason, that they are, the influence they have over American lives and the American economy has come under great suspicion. Just today, the day that we're talking, the federal government has filed its blockbuster antitrust suit against Google, which is a signal that that the suspicion is on the rise, and that at least politicians understand that the public wants them to do something about it, although we don't know what. We don't know how this will turn out. So you see those parallels. The Gilded Age, the first Gilded Age, this was a period of tremendous growth in wealth inequality. I tell the story in the book of the Bradley Martin Ball, which was a fin de siècle ball that symbolized the ostentation of this class of tycoon and their families, and was staged at a time when there were layoffs and wage cuts throughout the railroad industry, and labor was really on its back. So so we had that, and we see the same ostentation, maybe until the last few months or years, in the way that that American tycoons and billionaires today present themselves. And of course, in that age and this age, they're very defensive about their wealth, but it doesn't necessarily lead to them spending it particularly wisely or fairly.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great way to end this. I mean, it's you know, I'll just say it's kind of sad that, you know, we, you know, did control the spending and wealth of these incredibly rich capitalists, you know, through much of the 20th century. And your book is kind of the beginnings of people talking about this. And now, you know, 125 years later, we just let all this go, and we're back in the same position that we were in. And, you know, we'll see what the future holds. I mean, you know, by January could be a little bit of a different world in terms of these things.
Right. Well, as you said, you know, this is not a country that has a history of learning much from its mistakes. And you know, I'll close by citing a phrase that's often attributed to Mark Twain, but probably apocryphally, which is that history may not always repeat itself, but it often does rhyme.
Yeah. Well, and thank you for that. And again, we've been talking to Michael Hiltzik and his incredible new book, Iron Empires, Robber Barons, Railroads, and the Making of Modern America. Thank you again, Michael.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.